And we get the hour underway by welcoming into the program writer Colin Fleming. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, buddy. You ever have straight-up cranberry juice?
Yes, and it doesn't taste anything like that ocean spray stuff.
That's some sting to it, doesn't it?
Ooh, yeah. It's, as they say here in Maine, it's tat.
Yeah, I was actually just wondering if there were cranberry bogs in Maine. It seems like a good Maine product because it's such a like Cape Cod product, and I was quaffing some for my blood pressure before I came on, and I thought, yeah, that will... Well, I'm putting some hair on the chest.
Oh, yeah. Now, do you think you need to attempt to lower your blood pressure before we converse?
Oh, you know what? I pre-dosed with Advil, so I should be good. Although I did take a baby Tylenol for my heart, but I do that anyway.
You're not the only guest, I'm sure, that pre-doses before they come on here.
Well, if you pre-dose too many times, though, right, you just dull the effect. It doesn't work, and then you're migraine man. And I've already slipped myself melatonin, so I have to be up early in the morning. I can't be migraine man.
All right. You got it. It's all in balance, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm heavily medicated with over-the-counter CVS drugs.
Yeah, with natural supplements.
Yeah, that's how I keep going.
Well, a lot of things to cover, as always, here. And we'll talk about Major League Baseball, the NHL, as we go. But want to begin by talking about what's going on in the country, the protests around the nation, and get some of your thoughts. You spoke about them on your blog, the Many Moments More blog. But overall, where are you coming from on this?
You know what? It's just such a sad period in the sense that things aren't more sad than they usually are. Just sometimes certain things are pulled into light, and I guess what makes me sad more than anything is that these things are always out there, and the way we go about the ethical components of our lives now is largely social media driven, and that makes ethics and it makes morality phasic. What occurs because it's placed in front of your face becomes the thing that we purport to care about. And we expend really low-level energy, much drum-banging, but really low-level energy in what we purport to care about. We throw up the Facebook filter. We put up the black background, like straight out of Tristram Shandy on Instagram. And yet we really don't do anything more. And we also have a tendency to discriminate in terms of what's going to be the sort of in vogue modes of discrimination at the time. So other things that are horrible can be happening that are the antithesis of anything equitable. Other people can be murdered. Other people can be murdered the same way. Other people can have their livelihoods taken from them, all sorts of things. They can all be going on simultaneously. In fact, it is. But it's like one thing is going to capture an imagination that's going to be largely social media-driven, click-driven, and these things are always out there. And I feel like if we care that much, nothing is ever stopping you from at any point in your life and actually putting in the effort to make a difference, to try to make a difference. And making a difference doesn't come from showing up in a flash mob-style type protest. Making a difference is what accrues over decades of effort by an individual and thousands of hours. People just want to put up the filter. And I think that that's emblematic of how ethically hypocritical we can be these days.
Well, the easiest outrage is social media outrage. But I wonder, too, I think a lot of people feel fairly powerless in these situations, and how much of what we see out there on social media is driven by that helplessness, but a need to do something, and how much is also driven by wanting to be part of that thing that's going on?
Yes, the latter point that you make. It's communal, and communal and desiring to be a part of a community is often not about a cause. It's often not about right or wrong. It's often a matter of belonging. It's also often a matter of who will have me. Where can I feel that I have a stability and an identity in a world where we are frequently devolving in our identities, where we're becoming people who do not have identities at all? We have a pack mentality. And I think what social media is doing to us is fundamentally altering our ethical DNA. We look to social media for plaudits, for recognition, for being able to tell ourselves that we are good people. But when we are good people, it is in quietude. It is in lonely moments of grueling effort that we are good people, for which we often do not get any credit beyond maybe we help someone out directly. A thank you. We often don't get that. That's where change comes. And we can say everything we want about the cause, man. But the cause is, feel that strongly about something? Quit your job. Go work in a different job in an inner city. Put in the time. Have a different quality of life. Walk the walk rather than just click the click. It's not anything that's going to be a solution. And it's going to pass. It's going to drift out of our ken. And because we are creatures now who will only be mentally occupied with things that drift into our ken, like a child who has keys dangled in front of it, stops crying. It's like, ooh, that's awesome. I love that. Keys go away, the child cries again. Something else comes into our ken, and that becomes our focus. For the time it takes to go online, the time it takes to show up at Boston Common, but then it goes away, and we forget about it, and it's the next thing. Because, again, commitment to what is right and wrong is not phasic. And by phasic, I mean there's nothing trend-centric about it. It's a choice to make a difference, and that takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of commitment.
And you're absolutely right, and all of this will be for naught, you know, all of the posts, all of the hand-wringing, if something shiny comes along in another week and we focus on that and we don't make any effort to address the problems that are real and are systemic. But that takes work. And as you said, that takes an effort every single day. It's not something you're going to solve in one protest, one parade, one letter to the editor, and certainly not in one Facebook post.
I literally, because right now, while I'm asleep, a lot of the stories you read from me I've actually come up with and worked on. I know the title, While I'm Asleep. So I actually work 24/7 now. In fact, I was thinking about this as I was coming on the line. You and Carrie are literally often the only two people I speak to every week. It's just this, because I just work. I'm trying to deal with something in a very discriminatory-based situation. And I watch the same people in publishing who hate me for what I achieve take to social media constantly. 30, 40, 50, 60 posts a day about what great people they are who care so much about what is just. And they don't. They're the worst people I've ever known. And I think a lot of people, they're not to the degree that a lot of people in publishing are, but there's just that moral hypocrisy. Look how COVID has been absorbed by this narrative of right. What has come out of Minnesota and has had these ripple effects throughout the country. You'd think now that it was like, our bad. Like, it wasn't this thing, because now it's okay on the political dime for people to gather. And political leaders are saying, you know what, that's fine. The thing that we were barking at you about 4 days ago, 5 days ago, week and a half ago, it's fine. You can do this. This is also going to help me get reelected. And it's all just interconnected, and that people tend to be out for themselves. It's human nature and how human nature has always been. It doesn't mean everybody is that way. But when you inject social media into that, which is all about being out for yourself for the most part, with few exceptions, you're just going to get this pretend culture, a culture of pretend.
Yeah, because social media is the chance to craft this, for most people, artificial persona. Who puts up the horrible things that happen to them? Oh, there are those people that will just use it as a platform to tell you how awful their life is. But most people create this image of themselves through what they post and what they share and what they say. And the family, we all do it. I'm certainly guilty of it myself, but others take it to an even greater degree. And so it's the ultimate in self-gratification.
People want to go on social media when they haven't been on there for 10 minutes. And what they want to see, and I think they're crestfallen if they don't, I never get any because I'm doing something different. And I am speaking a truth, and I am writing about truth, and constantly. And people find me intimidating, so they don't gravitate towards me as of yet on social media. I can have something in the magazine that has a circulation of 9 million. I'm not going to get 4 likes for that. But when people do go on social media and they see that they don't have the number of likes they wish to have, they're crestfallen. I think that's their first response. Now, sometimes you have a business and the hours change and social media is great for that, or you have this new color of paint that you're pushing. Fine, I understand that. Or maybe you want to share great music by the Five Royales or Charles Mingus, and you listen to this and listen to this with everything going on in the world. I get that. But most people really go on there to curry the favor of the like. And that is how they measure their self-esteem now. Many people. The majority, I would say.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's shift gears and go to the sports world and Major League Baseball. You've said more than once with us that maybe there shouldn't be any sports at all this year. What should Major League Baseball do to save its game?
Remember the 1981 strike season, and the Yankees and the Dodgers were in the World Series, and so, of course, the Yankees win the pennant, the Dodgers win the whole shebang. Do you know that that year, the Boston Red Sox, they played an uneven amount of games, so, like, I think the Red Sox had played one less game than the Yankees, or the other way around. The Red Sox, their cumulative record that season was only one game worse than the New York Yankees, and they weren't in the playoffs.
Right.
Because you had so few games that you were working with. And I think with baseball, when you don't have a lot of games, which they're not going to be able to have now, you're going to end up with an extremely distorted outcome. You're going to have an asterisk season. You're not going to have quite the asterisk season in the NBA because it's such a star-driven league. There's not the capriciousness that accrues over a baseball season. There is rhythm to a baseball season. There are strange funks. There are funks that bring teams together to have long winning streaks. That's the nature of the grind of baseball. Take the grind out of baseball. I don't think you really have baseball. And I was thinking about how flawed the game has become. The three natural outcomes, right? You have everyone up there swinging for the fences. The guy who used to be the middle infielder who did six home runs a year is now popping 32. And everybody wants to walk, and the games take forever. I thought, you know what? They're going to fall behind hockey, and more on that in a second. They should just scrap the season and fix their game. Speed up this game. This game is, I'm really kind of like their ideal customer in the sense that I have no life. I have no friends. I have nowhere to go. I just work, and I have the game on. And they take so long. It takes 3.5 hours to play. And that used to be a Red Sox-Yankees game in 2004, kind of a special game that was long because they were competing so hard and working counts. But now everything, the Seattle Mariners and the Cleveland Indians in the middle of July is a 3-hour and 45-minute game. And they need to speed it up because they're going to lose. They're losing generations now, I feel, is what's going to happen. And these guys right now, the Mike Trouts and everything, that's fine. But you wonder who's going to come up even playing baseball. Who are going to be the future fans of 2040?
Well, I guess my question would be if they take a year off, though, a game that's already slipping in popularity, does it slide even further out of the public consciousness?
I don't think so, because the onus on you is then to radicalize the changes. You can't dither around. You have to have the pitch clock. You have to come back with something bobbly, bright, shiny, new, souped up, swift, aerodynamic. You cannot putz about with this at this point because the game is just, you're going to get this false positive of the season. And it's such a mess. And they also right now are running the risk of not being able to come together on something. And if they don't come together on something, the players union and the owners, they're going to lose everybody anyway. Players say, I'm not going to risk my health and there's less money, and they keep going on and on. Now I see it's a 114-game season. That's the most you can have, it seems like, at this point. The 1981 season, I think, was like 108 games. And again, it's like this false positive, even with the individual players. Like Dwight Evans and Bobby Gritch, among others, tied for the American League Home Run League that year.
With 22 apiece, right?
But that's not, like, real.
Right.
That's just like Wally Joyner was hot for a while in 1986. And it's like, ooh, the triple crown for Joyner. It's not real. And they're getting to that point where this is also not going to be real.
Right. On the other hand, the National Hockey League, with their 24-team playoff fan, you think has got a chance to really showcase something this year with their postseason.
They have this one-off that could be galvanizing for the league. And I think if the baseball is not gotten correctly soon, that the NHL, with what they're going to have for this year, people being so sports crazy, it can actually overleap America's former national pastime. I think it can make a move from the fourth spot to the third spot. Now, the NHL has always been good at changing the playoff system on the fly, which sounds strange, but when you think like through your memories, like remember like that there was a best of three series in the first round for a while and a best of five for a long time, then they would just change. One year it's like Adam's division, Patrick's division, they're like, no more, these are gone. And they just, the NHL morphs, I don't know why, but it morphs quickly for some reason. And you get these new playoff matchups, you get these weird upsets, and now you have this long layoff. Everybody's momentum is off. I think you're going to see teams that have to play first-round series that were not going to be in the playoffs before. We mentioned Chicago earlier. They're going to upset teams that have that kind of round-robin for seeding. Because the round-robin for seeding, the Bruins, they'll be vulnerable to a team like the Rangers. That round-robin for seeding, like, yeah, you want to have, like, the good seeding, but you're also not do or die. You're not, by definition, you're just not going to take it as seriously as you would when you're playing for your playoff life. So those other teams are going to be playing at, like, major league level, and the teams for seeding are going to be at, like, AAA level, and then they're going to meet up. Somebody's going to be playing with house money, and they're going to have confidence in a hot goalie. Somebody's going to feel the pressure, and you're just going to have this free jazz, Ornette Coleman wildness happening on the ice.
We were talking the other day about Tuukka Rask, who's been around so long. He started so young. I think of him as being older than he actually is. But he's even talking at a relatively young age for a goaltender about maybe getting to the end of the line soon.
Goalies age very well. Tim Thomas, just really kind of like the ultimate example of that. And actually, Dwayne Roloson. Remember that Lightning series, that great series the Bruins had with the Lightning that year they won the Cup? I think Roloson was older than Thomas. Three of those two guys going at it. But Rask is like Bergeron. He's been around for a long time. And Bergeron is from the cusp of the high def era. That's how long he's been on the Bruins. And we've spoken before about how they've kept this core together for really a surprising amount of time. Rask should, if he does not get bamboozled out of it, like it seems like Panarin is going to get bamboozled out of the Hart Trophy, he should win the Vezina Trophy this year. Now, the hardest position to make the Hall of Fame in the NHL is far and away goalie. Goalies do not make the Hall of Fame. Tom Barrasso is not in the Hall of Fame. Should be in the Hall of Fame, but you have to have like multiple Vezinas, or you have to be on a dynastic team, and you have to usually have a Conn Smythe. So Tim Thomas has two Vezinas. People forget the first one, and a Conn Smythe, maybe the best playoff run I've ever seen a goalie have. Tuukka Rask, if he gets the Vezina this year, he would have won the Conn Smythe last year if they hadn't just gagged away that Game 7 at home. They win the Cup this year, and he gets the Conn Smythe, and he has the Vezina. He's in the Hall of Fame. He can retire, and he's in the Hall of Fame because he has the career stats that Tim Thomas doesn't have. And it's like, it's just fascinating. You have this opportunity. And it's going to not last that long. Don't make it with this team. The team gets worse. You don't have another opportunity for a Vezina. You become this compiler. But he has this sort of like flashpoint right now, lightning in the bottle. Hit your mark, and you get to be a Hall of Famer forever. Isn't that crazy? It's just all of a sudden it's manifested that way.
The end-of-season awards being given out to Bruins with the greatest point total, the President's Cup, 100 points, I think six more than the next best team. And Alex Ovechkin tied for the Rocket Richard Award with David Pastrnak.
Yes, and Pastrnak had a much, much better year because Ovechkin, what did he have? His 12 assists, his 19 assists. He hits people, to give him credit for that. He doesn't carry the puck that much. He's lost some speed. He has become this one-timer. Like Tim Kerr used to be this slot presence, and that was what he did. He tipped shots. He cleaned up rebounds. But he even got more assists than Ovechkin did. But I would say that Pastrnak was the most consistently great player on the best team in the league. He was because Marchand, he's like a top 10 Hart guy this year, but he had dips in his game, little dips, not big dips, throughout the season. But Pastrnak, you could pencil him in for solid in his own end and an offensive force almost every night from just soup to nuts. I think Panarin of the Rangers, because he was like plus whatever he was, plus 34. I mean, he's the reason that they're the 10 games over 500. And you look at these guys on the Oilers, and you see these negative 12, these negative 9s for McDavid and Draisaitl. And it's like, how are you – you don't have, like, a sub-500 team. That to me, is an indictment. That's the kind of, like, a big deal. I don't think Pasternak has any chance to win the heart, but because he's going to go to the leading scorer in the league this year, and he's not going to obviously get his 50 goals because he was stopped shy there with the truncated season, but he's stacked some numbers now because he was popping for 35 goals, like he was always like knocking like star level, and now he's taken it to in a different level. And we share a Starbucks.
Well, they're even better. If that's not enough to get him an award, it ought to.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, when you think about my Starbucks, it's the regular Starbucks for Marchand, Pasternak, and then you have, like, this artist guy. Like, we're all in, like, it's weird. Like, isn't that weird? Like, you could do, like, this literary tour split. Like, that's the monument. That's the Starbucks where he wrote this book. And, like, Pasternak can park his Porsche here. And he actually parks his Porsche right outside the Starbucks. I see him all the time. Nice guy.
Excellent. Colin Fleming covering much wonderful ground, as always. Thanks for joining us this weekend. We'll do it again next Tuesday if that works for you.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Check out his work at colinflemminglit.com and the Many Moments More blog.